We're talking about how we view public spaces after back-to-back mass shootings in Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Walmart, a garlic festival, a nightlife district, these so-called soft targets have long been a concern to counterterrorism authorities. Venues, you may say, they add metal detectors, security officers picking through purses and bags, or even bomb-sniffing dogs. So what does aggressive security measures mean for the future of our public spaces? How do you think our country will handle safety in public spaces? Do you see the right amount of security at the places where you gather in your community? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Vita Bites is a sociologist at Yale University. She studies public space, surveillance, and uncertainty in social settings. Vita, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with, what do public spaces offer us as a society? Why do they matter?
Public spaces are incredibly important. They are venues where we get a sense of communal life, where we get a sense of belonging to others other than our immediate family, where we nurture our interpersonal relations with those who are not our immediate kin. They give us, health, sense of belonging, sense of inhabiting our neighborhood, our parks, our open spaces. They give us a sense of freedom, a sense of being creative in life, being alive, so to speak. They are incredibly important. And even more so now, I would say that since many of us choose to live in urban settings, our dwellings are becoming smaller and smaller because they're more and more expensive. And so that makes public space even more important, I would say.
Why is our sense of security important in these public spaces?
Well, in order to feel that your neighborhood, that your open space, your park, your hiking trail, your bike trail, your, pedestrian mall is something that you belong to, you have to feel comfortable. You have to feel safe. You have to feel like you can walk out without worrying about what's going to happen to you. That kind of sense of safety and security is really crucial. It's really fundamental to our, individual and collective health. So the question really becomes, how do you then design these spaces so that people feel comfortable?
Earlier this week, the sound of a motorcycle backfiring sent people into a panic at Times Square. They thought it was a shooting. How do these mass shootings affect the way that we look at these public spaces and how we view our security?
Yeah, these events are tragic in more than one ways. Obviously, they're tragic. Such mass shootings are tragic because there's loss of life, but they are also incredibly tragic because they are eroding our sense of community, our sense of, establishing relations with others, a sense of being related to a social group where we live. They are really incredibly destructive. And so, instead of worrying about, what you will do at work the next day, you're worried about whether you or even your children will be safe while you're working. So there's a multiple level of tragedy here when we have these mass shootings in such places.
We're talking about how we view public space in light of recent back-to-back mass shootings. Vita Bites is a sociologist at Yale University who studies public space and security and surveillance. How have mass shootings affected the way you view public spaces? How do you think our country should handle safety in these spaces? Do you see instances where there is too much security crackdown or not enough? What is your feeling of going to fairs and festivals? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Dave now, joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I want to make a comment somewhat related to this topic here. I guess, you know, I'm concerned about the desensitization of kids and others as well to guns due to overexposure in our everyday life. The specific example that I'm concerned about is a new gun store and shooting range that's currently being built in a commercialized area in the city of Baraboo, and it's only less than 5 miles from Devil's Lake State Park, which is a very popular state park, obviously. And this is not some back corner hidden in the local sporting goods store. And this facility is going to be as visible as a fast food store. And when kids and others drive by this routinely, you know, I'm worried that they're going to start to view this as nothing out of the ordinary. And, you know, someday when they're old enough, some of them might want to check it out. The current state laws, in fact, and the local laws, don't prohibit the construction of this type of facility. So it seems like it's, you know, kind of a cancer in our current laws. It's allowing it to spread.
Dave, thanks for the call, where Dave is basically seeing gun culture on Main Street. How does our gun culture complicate our view of public spaces, Vita?
Yeah, that is, that's a very important question. We live in a culture where people feel very strongly about their right and freedom to have weapons to protect themselves. And what's really tragic here is that people feel that they cannot trust the in state institutions of public order, right? That's why they feel that they must be able to protect themselves, because no one else will protect them, right? So that's one kind of sentiment. On the other hand, there's this pressure and expectation that the state will nevertheless do whatever it takes to protect the public from such mass shootings and other such interruptions of collective public life. So we have here a paradox that there is, you know, that's actually a tragic paradox, because there's no way, easy way out of this. So on the one hand, people want to protect themselves because they feel that no one else will protect them. And on the other, they demand that the state does something, whatever it takes to secure a public space. And here the ultimate question really is, what does this mean for our, you know, democratic political life and social life? And this is the kinds of questions that we should be asking. This is the debate that we really should be having, right? So where is this leading?
What can we learn, Vita, about other countries, how other countries approach this, public spaces and security? Does it look different than here in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, it depends, right? So every country has to be looked at separately, because every country has its own history, its own culture, its own sense of what it means to be safe, right? So these vary from culture to culture. What it means to have a disorder. For some people, it's just, oh, two people are fighting. For others, it's, oh, this is danger to my life, right? So there are different perceptions of order and disorder and what is disturbance and so on, right? And what makes people feel safe. So these are the kinds of studies that we really still need to do. We have not done those cross-cultural studies.
We're talking with Yale University sociologist Vita Bites. She's with us. She studies our evolving public spaces and how we view security in them. How do you want to see our public spaces organized so they're safer? Or do you not see a clear solution to safety and security? Do you trust fellow Americans as you gather in public spaces? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a moment for this conversation. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about safety in public spaces and whether recent mass shootings undermine our freedom to gather. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. After back-to-back mass shootings, authorities and businesses are forced to rethink how people congregate. Securing the space may take a high priority, and that can lead to security crackdowns or even the diminished use of a particular area that people would gather. So how have the mass shootings affected the way you view public spaces? Will you think twice about attending a music festival or seeking out an entertainment district on Friday night? We're at 800-642-1234. Vita Bites is a sociologist at Yale University, where she studies public space and security, and she stays with us. Vita, let's pick up the conversation where we left off as we look at other countries. I read this morning the State Department issuing a level 2 warning on France. And earlier this spring, it said we should exercise increased caution in France due to terrorism and civil unrest. And the travel advisory, I noticed, had a bunch of tips if you decide to travel in France. Beware of your surroundings as a tourist in large crowded public venues. Avoid demonstrations. Review your travel plans if you're in France on weekends. Find a safe location and shelter in place at large gatherings or protests. So there are these tips worth making me think differently about public spaces in a country that I think is safe, France.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, France is now basically politically in a process of, you know, mass social movement. And so we know that, you know, every weekend there are going to be demonstrations and so on. So these are sort of predictable things. But France, you know, like some other European countries, have had instances of, you know, terror attacks. But that's a little bit different, I would say, that because we know that weapons are not so widely available nor used as we have the case here in the United States. So it's a little bit different, I would say. But, you know, again, so things are changing. They're changing in this country, and they're changing in Europe and some other countries around the world. So where all this leading, is leading. This is, I think, a very good question. People are certainly afraid, and there is this great anxiety building up. What this means for people's choices in public spaces becomes probably one of the more important questions. We don't really know yet where things will go, but some of my research suggests that what we will see is or are highly controlled public spaces where, you know, all your communication is intercepted, you know, the digital communication, where your movement is monitored and where your movement is also curtailed in terms of what's allowed and what's not allowed. And that has, I would say, an incredible, incredible consequences for our collective social life and for our communal well-being and for our sense of, you know, interacting with strangers, going to places that we're not familiar with. It's not really clear how we will function as a society if our public spaces no longer function as public spaces as the way that they have been.
Because it cuts to the heart of a democracy.
It definitely cuts right in the middle of what kind of a society do we want to be. And that's the kind of discussion that we really need to have as a sociologist. That is what I'd like to see. What do we mean when we say we are a democracy? What does that mean? What are those values that come with it, right? Inclusion, open access, protection of privacy, of human rights, and so on. All of these are curtailed when public spaces become highly controlled through surveillance. And so then the question is, who is surveilling? Where is all this information going? Because, digital memory, which is what surveillance cameras and other surveillance technologies have, it doesn't forget. It remembers forever. So what does that mean? What I see is that the public is really not aware of the consequences. They're not really thinking down the road, where is all this going? That's the conversation that we really have to have. It may be that we no longer want to live in a democracy, but if that's the case, then we should all fully be aware of what this means and then all agree that that's the way that our society is going and that we're all okay with it. But what we should not do is sleepwalk into some kind of an centralized authority guiding our individual and collective life. That is the direction that we should not be going unless we're fully aware that this is what we want as a society.
We have Joe from Green Bay who called in and couldn't stay with us. And Joe is a teacher and wanted to know the best way to conduct an evacuation drill or an active shooter drill without inciting fear in students. Are there ways to address the threat of mass shootings and also minimize the impact on our perception of public spaces?
Well, clearly, you know, people should, you know, there are certain things that we should know how to do, but maybe one way would be to say, well, you know, we just need to clear the space. Let's just learn how to do that. And let's not worry about why we're doing that, right? Whether the building's falling apart or is there a fire or somebody's shooting, because it's that sort of encourages this kind of, you know, vision of fear. But maybe one way to do this would be to design the buildings in such a way that they can be cleared and emptied out very fast, right? Lots of exits so people can just walk out and you know, have a design so that we know clearly where people are going. I think one of the problems at Walmart was also that, you know, there's one entrance, one exit. That is, you know, also what has happened to lots of public buildings, that they now have one entrance, one exit. Because it's easier for, you know, security personnel to surveil who comes in and who goes out. So we will need to rethink, I think, the way we design these buildings.
We're talking about the impact of congregating in public spaces as we look at these mass shootings. Yale University sociologist Vita Bites studies this. What are your thoughts about going to Walmart, to big music events, to festivals? Do you think about safety? What about going to the grocery store or a night out in an entertainment district? What is on your mind about public spaces in terms of safety? We're at 800-642-1234. Vita, are the stakes different for the rich and the poor, people in different socioeconomic classes?
Yes, clearly so. Yes, that's one of the problems, because the more divided we become in terms of social class, the more this becomes, the public spaces become more of an issue for those of us who don't have private islands, who don't live in gated communities, who don't have, you know, security detail and so on. So yes, clearly, this becomes a problem for, you know, people who are not, we should say, elites, let's say. It's because the elites have already figured out a long time ago how to protect themselves from any kind of violent interruption. This really wouldn't be their problem. This would be our problem, the problem of those of us who just live, you know, everyday life. Yes.
Well, as you research this complex problem and we approach our thinking toward public space, what should we set as our expectations for safety in public spaces? Is it realistic to find a common ground here?
Well, we have to be looking for a common ground, because there is only one common public space for most of us, except, let's say, for the elites who choose to live in their own environments. So we really have no other choice. We have to look for creative solutions. We have to do that, because otherwise we will become prisoners of our own home, so to speak, however small that may be. And that is not conducive to any kind of collective social life. So we really must find solutions. We have to have public discussions like the one we're having today. We must listen to everybody, because everyone has their own concerns, and then basically through this kind of a dialogue come up with whatever solutions. But we also should be looking at other settings in other places around the world when we have high complexity, right? How do people deal with this uncertainty? And perhaps we can learn from examples from other cultures. So that's also the kind of research that needs to be done, I would say.
So you see a lot more research here going forward.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Well, Vita, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Vida Bites is a sociologist at Yale University, and she studies public space and surveillance and security. Coming up, we'll discuss how to talk with kids about violent acts that are in the news and in our communities. Did you have a conversation about mass shootings with a child in your life? How did it go? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Let's talk about it right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about how to talk with kids about mass shootings and feeling safe at school. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. When and how do you tell young children about an act of violence in their community or beyond? How do you start that conversation? Because the last thing you want is for them to find out from someone else and that they think you're not willing or able to tell you important things. So have you had a conversation with your child about gun violence in the news? And what did it sound like? How did they receive it? Join in at 800-642-1234. Kathleen Hipke is a clinical psychologist at SSM Health Dean Medical Group, and her practice focuses on child and family psychotherapy and treating trauma in infants and children. Kathleen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So how do kids process events like the shootings we saw in El Paso and Dayton? And I'm assuming you break it down at different age groups, but what is the process like?
I think you make an excellent point, Kate, that it really depends on the developmental level of the child. Obviously, older kids and teens are going to have a much more sophisticated understanding. But young children actually need quite a bit of help making sense of these kinds of stories. For example, a young child who sees an image on television may not understand that that's not happening right outside their door, right down the street, or in real time.
How can parents assess whether they should talk with their children about these shootings?
That's such a big and important question, because I think as adults, we so much want to protect children that there is a tendency to want to move into silence and hope that perhaps they haven't heard about it or they don't know about it. In most cases, especially in this day and age of social media, 24-hour news, that sort of thing, most kids do, even young kids. They are at least aware that the adults around them perhaps are stressed, talking about something difficult and heavy that's happened. And so we really tend to believe that it is better to start the conversation than not, because we don't want children to feel isolated or alone in making sense of such big topics.
Oh, especially if the big TV screen in the background has, you know, the cable news 24/7 channel up and they're seeing these images, hearing these words.
Absolutely. Whether that's in the home, but also in public spaces, going into, a private office, a clinic, a grocery store, it's pretty ubiquitous.
So as you approach that conversation, how do you enter into a type of conversation like that? What does that entry point look like?
You know, we also fear a lot that we're going to introduce anxiety to children. So I think it's really helpful to think about starting from a very open-ended place, asking questions to find out how much has your child heard and what sorts of beliefs or feelings might they have about what's happened. So things like, have you heard? about what happened in the news today. Did you hear that some people got hurt? That sort of thing. And starting there, and then just listening and really trying to pick up what their understanding is, what their concerns and questions might be.
Oh, kind of letting them guide you as to where we're going in this conversation about something that's really difficult.
Absolutely.
How do shootings affect the way children look at and regard their public spaces and specifically their schools?
Such an important question, and I wish there was a single answer. There really isn't. It depends so much on the child, where they are developmentally, and how close they feel or don't feel to what has happened. One of the things I think about a lot are children who have perhaps already experienced personal violence or community violence, and what gets stirred up for those kids when then we have an event like we've had in the last week where we've had two mass shootings and those images are on television in the news and a concern, of course, for everybody around them.
So that might be a trigger for them if they've had violence in their own community, maybe next door or in their own home.
Absolutely.
We're talking about how to talk to kids about gun violence in the news. Clinical psychologist Kathleen Hipke focuses on child and family psychotherapy and treating trauma in infants and children. Do you have a child who is asking questions about the shooting and you don't know how to respond? What do you want to ask the psychologist? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Kathleen, if a child appears to be unfazed by shootings, should parents still try to have that conversation with their child to help them process events like in El Paso and Dayton, or should you just leave it alone?
I think that really goes back to what we were saying before, which is that you can let your child lead. We need to create the space and the permission that this is something that we can talk about. But as we listen and we watch our children, if they are really indicating that this is not something, at least in this moment, that they have questions and concerns about, we can leave it there. But once the permission has been granted and that door has sort of been opened, that this is something that is really big and overwhelming, but it's speakable. And I'm one of the sort of bigger, wiser, stronger people in your life who could speak to it with you. Kids often will come back around if there are concerns at different times.
Let's look at those teenage years when that is pre-adulthood, but still lots of feelings, lots of emotions during that time, and lots more activity in social media. How do we talk to our teenagers?
I'm going to go back to it is the same and different. So really creating space, letting teenagers know I'm available to speak about this. We can assume that almost across the board, they do know about it. You know, teenagers, in addition to being sort of more out and independent in their own spaces, they're also working on autonomy from the adults in their lives. So they're not always going to be as clear about saying, gosh, I'm feeling more anxious. I really want to sit next to you. But I think as adults, what we can do is just make ourselves available. Look for the opportunities when an older child or a teen might, for example, just want to hang out more in the same room. When they might want to talk in the car. That's always a popular one with teenagers, you know, when you're riding along. You just never quite know when the moments are going to come, but looking for them and really being available to listen.
What if the feeling out of that teenager is anger? A lot of anger about what has happened.
I think that it would make sense. I think as adults, that is also a struggle with a range of emotions, anger being one of them. And I think that also one of the things we can hold in mind is that these are opportunities for us as adults to come alongside our kids with whatever age they're at to help model, coach, be connected to them around what do we do in moments when we are overwhelmed by emotions of any sort. listening. It goes back to listening first and creating a space to acknowledge that, yes, you have a huge range of emotions and they're intense. And we'll also want to be able to start balancing that with other messages that might help children and teens feel more settled.
What might those other messages be?
Well, you know, I think there are many. And so that's a bright point. Mm-hmm. I do go back in my mind often to the advice of Fred Rogers, who we all know as Mr. Rogers from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And he did a lot of work with youth and community violence outside of his television program. And one of the things he always said is help children see the helpers. So, again, depending on the age and developmental status of the child, we can think with them about both holding, you know, sort of all this emotion, whether it's grief or anger, and remembering that there are lots of adults, and our teens are thinking about becoming those adults who are working to prevent these things, first responders who are showing up often very quickly and providing aid, and everybody in the aftermath, you know, the friends, the families, the faith leaders, the counselors who show up with food and hugs and support day after day for families who have been directly impacted.
And they'll find that the helpers are all around them.
Absolutely. I think that's actually what we're talking about today is how can we in our lives, whether we work with children or we have children in our homes, how can we be the helpers who come alongside as they're trying to make sense of this?
We had a caller earlier this hour, a teacher who asked about active shooter drills, evacuation drills, and they were concerned about these drills inciting fear in students. How do we talk with kids about these drills?
That's a huge question and a really important one. I think there's a lot of controversy as to whether or not we're doing that well, whether or not we are doing it with children too young. But I think we have to go back to some of the same concepts. We want to help kids, you know, sort of be prepared about what to do in an emergency, but we want to keep the focus really on, again, what is helpful? Who are the important, bigger, stronger, wiser people in your environment? Who can you turn to? And how can we be connected to each other when we are grappling with something heavy?
Yeah, because that support system around you gives you that strength to carry on. And it also, you can share those feelings.
Absolutely.
We're talking about how to talk with children about mass shootings and the violence that we see in the news and in our own communities. Clinical psychologist Kathleen Hipke focuses on child and family psychotherapy and treating trauma in infants and children. Are you struggling with your feelings after the string of mass shootings? What are you experiencing? And what do you want to know about those emotions, how to cope? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about how to talk with children about violence, specifically the string of mass shootings in the news. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Children may feel very helpless, as do adults, but what words do you use to describe these difficult events? And if these acts of violence happen more often, does that change how we talk about this? Join in the discussion about how you've approached this topic with the people in your life, especially the children. It's 800-642-1234. Clinical psychologist Kathleen Hipke stays with us, and she focuses on child and family psychotherapy. Kathleen, kids aren't the only ones who might have a difficult time grappling with what is happening in the news with violence. What kind of questions might adults have after these kinds of tragic events?
Well, I think one of the things I hear a lot is the very topic that you're allowing us to speak to today is how do I find the words to communicate with my child, how much to say, those sorts of things. And also how will we feel safe in public spaces as these things are becoming seemingly more common.
When we go to public spaces, whether it be a festival, whether it be the grocery store, should we be looking for signs from our own kids if they are feeling uncomfortable, or what types of things should we be picking up on?
I think it goes back to really following our kids' leads again. And absolutely, it's helpful to always be a strong observer. And when kids are showing signs of discomfort, to get curious about that and wonder with them about what we're seeing. And again, I think we can be very open-ended about that. You're looking a little unsettled. You're looking nervous. I'm wondering what's happening. And then follow their lead about what their concerns are or are not.
Even for people who haven't lost someone in recent shootings, can you still feel grief?
I think that it's possible to feel a wide range of strong emotions in response to these sorts of events. I mean, they really do induce a sense of horror and deep compassion and sadness. And as you mentioned, anger for so many people. And there's no one way to experience the emotional sequelae. And that's true for kids as well.
People grieve in so many different ways, as you mentioned. How can that affect their acceptance of help or their willingness to seek help?
Well, I think that the primary focus that I come back to with kids is their greatest helpers are the grownups who are right there in their lives, their parents, their grandparents, teachers, coaches, that sort of thing. And kids do have different thresholds for help seeking. I really am appreciating the comment you made about though observing kids and sort of those who don't maybe come forth maybe verbally or in more obvious ways with their discomfort, that as adults we can kind of come alongside them, be a presence, create opportunities, wonder a little bit about how they're feeling so they just know that that person's available if and when they're ready to seek something more specifically.
What about our own words and actions and how we carry ourselves in these public spaces? What impact does that have on our kids?
That's really important. Especially for younger kids, they're looking to us as adults to determine how should I feel? How should I think about this? So if they are noticing that the adults in their lives are particularly anxious, that is going to be very disconcerting for them. So having an awareness of how we carry ourselves is really important and helpful to kids if we can both acknowledge when there are those moments that we are feeling more worried and let them know that also as adults, we can handle that. We can take care of that. They don't need to do that for us.
At what point should counseling or therapy be part of the conversation, be part of the solution for people?
The interesting thing here is that while these events evoke such horror, as they very well should, we are also remarkably resilient. And most kids, if they do show distress in response to these sorts of things, the exposures to media, will sort of settle within days or weeks. We get concerned when difficulties become persistent. So kids remain frightened, they have difficulty sleeping, settling themselves down, that sort of thing, of after a month or longer.
As we start to wrap up here, can you provide any tips for us with the media in our life, with the phones in our life and the screens, how that impacts how we view our world?
Absolutely. We have such constant access now, and especially for children, but this is true for adults as well. We need breaks. So being aware and well-informed and then turning it off and doing the things in our day-to-day life that create a sense of normalcy is critical for children, but also for adults. So being able to say, let's turn off the TV, let's make dinner, let's take a walk, let's just play, are critical.
Kathleen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Kathleen Hipke is a clinical psychologist at SSM Health Dean Medical Group. Wisconsin's startup industry lags behind neighboring states, but Milwaukee's tech community is hoping to build on some small successes. Corrine Hess reports.
Moments before a recent wedding show in downtown Milwaukee, members of Jared Judge's string quartet were beginning to panic.
The one time that I didn't check to see if there was a set list.
A member of Judge's quartet was in a minor accident. Her car was towed, and inside was all of the music the group needed to perform.
We're just solving that problem right now. BookLive has our parts on it, so we're going to download them and print them right here.
BookLive is a social networking app that Judge developed with a partner while in grad school at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Because that's the dream, is you just show up, play, and collect a nice check afterwards. But the reality of it is you have to learn to be a business person, too.
The lifelong musician also happened to be a self-taught computer programmer. BookLive looks similar to LinkedIn. The app helps other freelance musicians manage their schedules and keep track of their finances. It's free. And when a performer is paid through BookLive, Judge receives a portion of the transaction fee. So far, about 500 people have signed up. Matt Cordio is the founder and president of Startup Milwaukee and Startup Wisconsin. He says freelance musicians face the same challenges as startup companies.
Leveraging his experience kind of being a musician has been able to build this really great technology company that we hope obviously continues to grow and expand and scale way outside of Wisconsin.
BookLive picked up steam last year, winning competitions at UWM's Lubar School of Business and also gaining the attention of Milwaukee angel investor Jim Miller. Miller has invested $100,000 in BookLive. That set Judge's experience apart from a lot of entrepreneurs in Milwaukee. And Miller wants to change that.
The people with money have not invested in this community. They've gone to safer havens where entrepreneurs and tech-savvy people have proven success.
The Kaufman Index of Startup Activity has consistently ranked Wisconsin and Milwaukee near the bottom in business creation and growth compared to the rest of the country. Metropolitan Milwaukee ranked 39th in 2017. That's tied with Pittsburgh for the lowest ranked major metropolitan area. That same year, Wisconsin ranked last for larger state rankings. The state also ranked last in 2016.
You know, if you look at Silicon Valley, I mean, they invest millions and tens of millions of dollars or hundreds of millions. So even our bigger companies have been very, very modest in their investment here.
Miller says Judge's company intrigues him because the concept can be done anywhere in the world and translated to nearly any profession. Miller is one of the founding members of Xywave. That company was started in 1995, and with about 300 employees, it's one of Milwaukee's most successful technology startups. By comparison, Verona-based Epic has about 9,000 employees.
When you compare Dane County to Milwaukee County, we're not even on the map.
Cordio believes Milwaukee needs to be doing a better job of telling the rest of the country its success stories, the way Madison has. Cordio says there is untapped talent in Milwaukee, and some companies are beginning to take notice. Madison-based American Family Insurance plans to open an office in downtown Milwaukee.
Because they realize there is tech talent here, and we are in appreciated market.
Milwaukee may never be thought of as a destination for budding entrepreneurs, but the city's tech scene is growing, and boosters like Miller and Cordio believe the trend is likely to continue. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.